It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Women make up about 35% of all the agricultural producers in Wisconsin. That's 5% higher than the national average. That's according to the 2017 Census of Agriculture. A project here in Wisconsin has been bringing together multiple groups to work with women to promote conservation and land stewardship. They celebrate a number of Wisconsin women in conservation in a new publication out this month called Portraits of Love on the Land. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you own, farm, or otherwise look after a patch of land in Wisconsin? What kind of practices do you have in place around conservation, big or small? Do you have questions about opportunities to promote different kinds of conservation on a small patch of land, big patch of land, any point in between? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Esther Durayraj is Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation. She's a research agronomist at the Michael Field Agricultural Institute. Esther, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Laura Langworthy is Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and an owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler. Lauren, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Esther, you've been celebrating a year of programming this year, including with this new publication I mentioned. Can you tell us what the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project is all about?
So thanks for asking me that question. Wisconsin Women in Conservation is a program that's funded by the Natural Resources Conservation Service and led by the Michael Field Agricultural Institute, which is based out of East Troy, Wisconsin. We partner with other nonprofits, as you mentioned, in Wisconsin, namely Renewing the Countryside, Wisconsin Farmers Union, and Marble Seed. And we work with women landowners, farmers, in order to bring education, outreach about conservation practices. And not only that, we bring resources, trying to bring in the finance, because women have a lot of questions on their mind. They are good stewards. As we know, women are nurturers by nature of their families, of their land. And so when they want to be better stewards of the land, they have this like a lot of questions about how to go about it. And is that even financially possible? So we try to be the intermediary, bringing people who are connecting women with women. We also bring NRCS resources to them and see how they can make their dreams possible for their land.
And Esther, looking at Portraits of Love on the Land, conservation and stewardship means a lot of different things. Can you talk about a little bit about the range of the projects that participants are doing on their own land?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this has been an enjoyable experience for us to bring out this book. So women are involved in grazing lands, in agriculture, in urban farming, wetland preservation, soil health, waterways. There's a lot of things that people, women have been working on to be better stewards of the land. And so we, as we work with these women, we want to kind of bring out their voices about what they have been doing. If you look at like many a times when we Google this, like, conservation, not many of those women pop up. So we want to change that landscape because women are doing a lot of things and we want to bring those stories to their forefront. And so this book has brought about all that, so many of their stories. And we thank those women who have shared their stories with us and to be open about it, to bring it to the public domain.
Lauren, let's visit Blue Ox Farm. Now, it sounds like when you and your partner started this off, you really did have conservation and stewardship in mind right at the outset. Can you talk a little bit about that mindset, first of all?
Absolutely. Well, when we started our farm, my husband, Caleb, it had really spent a lot of time aspiring to be a farmer and learning a lot about agriculture. And I was more of a nature kid who really enjoyed the outdoors and could picture myself living on a farm and all the wonderful things that could come with it, but certainly had a lot more to learn on the agricultural front. And since then, you know, our big adventure has been trying to figure out how to merge both of those visions and try and make our farm both a place that produces food and supports our community, but also has wild space for, you know, the badgers and the foxes and the grassland birds that are endangered. And so trying to balance kind of the economic piece and the personal livelihood, and then these larger goals for what our community community and our landscape should look like. It's definitely a challenge, but it's a fun challenge.
And your farm, what you actually produce there has evolved over the years. I read in the book here, and you've gone into grass-based animal production now, kind of as your main gig. Can you talk a little bit about how you do that with conservation and stewardship in mind?
Absolutely. Yeah. When we first started, we started with vegetable production, and we kind of joke that it's a good way to turn sweat into money. Doesn't take a lot of infrastructure to get going in vegetables, but it does take an awful lot of work. And as we were doing annual tillage and running a CSA and wholesale accounts and selling at farmers markets and into food co-ops, we were just feeling like we were spending a lot of time tilling soil and weeding. There was a lot of bare soil, even with the best production model that we were able to kind of muster. And I know some people who are able to do it much better than we were, but we were looking at ourselves and thinking, why can't we get more perennials into this system? And why can't we get more things covered and have less bare soil, less tillage? And so that really led us on some self-reflection and some business model reconsideration. And that's how we kind of ended up in livestock, specifically rotational grazing. And so that rotational grazing allows us to really provide some good habitat, do soil building and microbe building, create a healthy animal, and also kind of manage our own labor a little bit better.
We're talking about Wisconsin women in conservation. Lauren Langworthy is with us, owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler, and Esther Dreiraj, program director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation, also with the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a conservation or land stewardship project going on in your backyard, in your 40 acres, whatever land you're working with? Is there something you've been doing to maintain the soil, maintain animal and plant species and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Esther, for that new farmer, maybe a woman getting into farming for the first time or after growing up and then returning to a farm, what kind of help is out there for them here in Wisconsin? What kind of community and mentorship can they reach out for?
Okay. So the way we do our program is to have these for learning circle events. So when they do come into one of these events, they sit with a sister community of women farmers and landowners who are sharing their stories about how they started and how they built their farm, or if the new beginning farmer has questions, they are able to help them. And we also bring in the FSA and NRCS resource persons. So they are able to right away tell them what are the resources that's available for them for purchase of land or for building infrastructure or for all these conservation practices that they can do. And so they go back with a kind of a knowledge of what's available, what's existing. We also have conservation coaches. Lauren is one of our coaches here, who will be able to tell them what are the different things that, like, as she just mentioned, how she thought about a business plan and moved her farm along. These are the kind of stories that the women are exposed to, and they learn from each other. So this is basically a peer-to-peer model, and we kind of find motivation in each other and help the women grow in as a beginning farmer.
And Lauren, I'm looking at a picture of you educating in the book right now. I think, why was it important for you not just to try to make your farm operation a success, but to share lessons you learned along the way with others?
That's a great question. You know, as farmers, we are so busy. We have to have so many different types of skills, from business management to all the technical skills of livestock or plant management and health. And there's just so much that you need to learn. And it's really hard to start from zero in all of those arenas and become an expert in the time that we have. And you really only have one opportunity a season for most agricultural knowledge to be utilized, and then you have to wait until the next year to try it again. So I think any time that we can support each other by sharing the knowledge we've learned, especially about things that can be really complex, like how to navigate some of these government program opportunities or how different ecosystems function, it really helps us all get further when we can share that knowledge into a general pot as opposed to hold on to it all ourselves.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project and how it's helping women landowners and other women stewards of land in Wisconsin. Our guests are Esther Durayraj, Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation and Research Agronomist at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, and Lauren Langworthy, Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and an owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler. A new publication out called Portraits of Love on the Land tells the story of a lot of these women getting involved in farmland conservation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation. Are you doing some kind of conservation project on land you own, or on are you working maybe as a volunteer on public land? Love to hear your story. Or do you have questions for our guests about what it means to do land stewardship and conservation here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about Wisconsin Women in Conservation. Esther Durayraj is Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation and a Research Agronomist at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And Lauren Langworthy is Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler, featured in the new publication Portraits of Love on the Land. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer yourself on a large or small scale, what kinds of conservation things do you do? What kind of stewardship do you do for your soil and land? And wherever you are, whatever you do, do you try to plant maybe native species to help butterflies and other animal and insect species? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Esther, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this isn't one size fits all. A lot of different people do different conservation projects. How could people figure out, okay, this is the land I've got, this is the agriculture maybe I'm doing, what kind of conservation methods might be right for me?
So when the women or landowners or farmers come to one of our events and express interest in having a conservation plan, then we right away work with them. We just have something called an intake form where we get the information about their land, their practices that they're adopting as of now, and what they want to see on their land. Sometimes women straight away want to go in for cost share programs, which is the EQ through NRCS, and then we connect them to the NRCS, and the NRCS professionals walk their land and tell them what is possible for them. And sometimes women are not ready to go there. They just want to know what can they do, what are the possibilities, what are the limitations. And in that case, then we have the funding to have a technical service provider walk their land. We make those arrangements. We find the people to walk the land, give them, talk with them, talk about the dreams that they have for the land. Like, they may have certain dreams that can be possible or not. So this person who walks their land is able to tell them, who's a conservation professional, who's able to tell them what works, what may not, what's the other options that they have. And then at the end of it, they would get a conservation plan document, which they can have it, think about it, and then go for the next step as soon as possible or as late as possible. It depends on them. But they at least have a knowledge of what can be done on their land.
And Lauren, you give a top conservation tip in the Portraits of Love on the Land book. You start saying, start small. Make the case for being willing to start small, even if it doesn't seem like it's going to be a big difference maker.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a joke to those people who know me, but I'm not notorious for starting small or keeping things small. But it's actually really helpful, especially when you're looking at significant changes to a farming operation, to change, you know, a couple of smaller things and see if you like the direction it's going and give it some time to take hold, because conservation really isn't something that happens overnight. And a small change could take years, maybe even, to really reflect on the land. And so being gentle and patient with yourself and not feeling like you have to do it all at once, or you have to do really, really big things when you're not entirely certain, it can actually help the whole process go a lot more smoothly to make it more manageable and more achievable.
Esther, I wanted to highlight one project in particular. Now, we might think of agricultural stewardship and conservation is something that happens in rural Wisconsin, which it does. You feature, though, a project in Milwaukee. Can you talk a little bit about that one?
We have an urban ag network in Milwaukee as well, because, you know, actually for rural and urban settings, the agriculture is totally different sense. Many of the urban people are gardeners, community gardeners, or backyard gardeners, and we didn't want them to be let out off the loop. So we have them as well. As a part of our group, we meet separately in Milwaukee. We talk with them. Is there any pollinator planting that they would like to have? Is there, something with the vegetable gardens that they're raising? How can we help them? How can we have their land covered during winters, maybe a cover crop? So these are the options that we talk to them. And we also brought out a rainfall simulator a couple of months ago for them to see, like, realistically what happens when a rainfall event happens on their land. And, you know, we bring such kind of education, which opens the eyes for them to adopt various conservation measures, even if it's in a smaller scale.
And Lauren, can you talk a little more? We've talked about why you got into wanting to share education about conservation. On a practical level, what does it mean to be a conservation coach?
Well, that's another great question. I think it really depends on the person who's seeking information. So our role is not as formal as, you know, when you go into the NRCS office or the FSA offices or anything like that. No government centers here. We're just farmers talking to other farmers about what might work and what might not. And so I'm able to share with people when I kind of hear what kinds of questions they have and what kind of hopes and dreams they have, I can say, oh, I happen to know about this program that could maybe provide some cost share toward that bigger goal you have. Or I know about an organization that's doing some work in that arena that could help you find some more resources. There are networks of other men and women that to get connected with. And so it's really trying to hear what a person is looking for and help them along their pathway to just not have to do it alone and not have to find everything from scratch.
Talking to Lauren Langworthy and Esther Dureraj about the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project and the new book from that project, Portraits of Love on the Land, featuring women doing all different kinds of stewardship and conservation. Esther, can you talk a little more about why focusing on women in particular? You were starting to touch on that earlier. Can you talk a little bit about the particular needs of women in conservation and stewardship?
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. So the way we look at it, women are nurturers. We see that we take care of the family, we take care of relationships, we take care of the land. We are mostly the glue in every single thing that happens around us. And we see that women have great dreams for their land, but there are a lot of questions in the mind, like, is this workable? Is this financially feasible? And there are times that we find it difficult to ask those questions. And so when we bring a group of women together, we have seen this great bonding that happens within a period of an hour, because we sit in a learning circle. We start out with introductions, which talk about what do you look forward to your land and what have you done on your land. We have different set of questions at different events. And so people start talking about the land. And we have like a seasoned landowner. We have beginning farmers who people were seeking the land, who all are seeking for inspiration and motivation, and we learn from each other. It's a sense of togetherness, the sense of working together. So the way we feel is that, imagine if we can just bring about change in these number, 37% of women are producers now, and if we can bring about a change in how they steward the land in terms of conserving natural resources or bringing a big impact on the landscape, not only helps them, and the future generations, and the kids are watching their moms, and that's a big change. And that's what is our passion. Our team drives on that passion. We really want to bring about this love for the land, and that's one of the book. That's the title of the book as well. How we really want women who are already loving the land, and we want to give them the opportunities to take better care of that.
Got an email from Patty in Lake Mills who writes, I farm 1,000 acres with our dairy farm. We have a nutrient management plan for our land. We soil sample the land after every crop to see what nutrients the land needs. Also, we plant cover crops like triticale and winter wheat to keep soil in place. And we rotate between corn, alfalfa, and soybeans. As a fellow livestock farmer, Lauren, can you talk a little bit about some of the other conservation options open for people raising animals?
Yeah, as with many conservation opportunities, it depends so much what your goals are and what your current infrastructure is. And so, you know, on my farm, we're doing rotational grazing, which means moving animals from paddock to paddock regularly. In our situation, it's pretty much every day they move to a new paddock. And that allows us to capture that manure and urea and put it back into the soil and grow more grass. But not everybody is set up to do that. Not everybody has either the land base to do it or the labor to do it. And so there are a lot of different ways that people can improve the conservation around their farm. Anything from waterways to your caller mentioned planting cover crops to be able to capture some of that manure. There are just so many things. And depending on where you're starting from and where you're hoping to go, there are just so many opportunities for people.
Esther, in just our last minute or so, I understand the project has gotten an extension now for another couple of years. What are your hopes to accomplish over the next year or so?
Oh, we are moving into newer territories. We've been working in 18 tri-counties, in 18 counties, like six tri-county clusters over the last year. We're looking into moving into 12 more counties this year and the next. And so we really want more women to join us. At present, we almost have like last year alone, we reached out to about 1,000 women landowners who came to our programs and benefited from it. And we're looking to increase those numbers. We're looking to be of value to women landowners. And so I can just call out the names of the counties that we're going into next year: Trumbull, La Crosse, Monroe, Dane, Rock, Jefferson, Green Lake, Columbia, Sauk, Eau Claire, Chippewa, and Clark. If you're a woman landowner, please connect with Wisconsin Women in Conservation at www.wiwic.org, www.wiwic.org.
We'll get that up at wpr.org/centraltime as well, and we'll leave it there. Esther, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
And Lauren, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Esther Durayraj is Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation and a research agronomist at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And Lauren Langworthy is Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and an owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler. We talked to them today about the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project, how it's been helping educate and provide resources to women farmers and other land stewards around the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, are you a Felicity, a Kirsten, a Samantha, a Molly, or a Josefina? That's a common question among fans of the American Girl line of books and dolls. The brand was founded by Pleasant Roland in Wisconsin back in the 1980s, went on to become an icon of girlhood for many in the 1990s and 2000s. Beyond the dolls and books, American Girl turned into a kind of lifestyle brand for young girls, including, but not limited to, theater kits, recipes, paper dolls, a magazine, and advice books on health and friendship. Our next guest hosts a podcast that revisits the American Girl series through a historical lens. They've just co-authored a new book exploring what they call the wonderful and wild world of American Girl fandom. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have an American Girl doll when you were younger, or did your kids? Did you especially relate to any of the characters or their stories? What kind of influence has American Girl had in your life, in your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney are historians, co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast, and co-authors of that new book. It's called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. Allison and Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mary, let's start with you. You say in the podcast, in the book, that you're a total Molly. Now, for people who aren't familiar with the American Girl lineup, we're pretty familiar here in Wisconsin, but tell us a little bit about how you connected to one of the particular American Girl characters.
Sure. So I received Molly when I was 9 years old on Christmas Eve. So she was the first American Girl doll I'd ever heard of or met. And she lives during World War II, and I just was so fascinated by her books. I was always more of a fan of the books than dolls in particular. But really, for me, what made Molly my favorite was that she kind of, her stories function as a bridge to one of my favorite people in my life, my grandmother, who I'm named after, who I affectionately called Fluffy, who, you know, didn't read the books, but because I could ask her lots of questions about growing up during World War II and if she had a victory garden and things like that.
And Allison, you are also a longtime Molly. What led to that connection for you?
So my story is actually really similar. I also received a Molly as my entry point into the American Girl brand, but her stories were something that just really fascinated me. I loved to kind of step inside someone else's life, and I was very jealous of her bangs and her eyewear. So I did try to kind of facilitate the eyewear piece by just like failing an eye exam. That was not successful. Now I don't have to try. I fail all on my own. I got a haircut not long after getting my Molly. There was something about her spirit, her tenacity, her patriotism, all those things were just so fascinating to me. And for me, it was a bridge to my mom, who was a doll collector, loved playing with dolls and dollware. So it was just kind of a whole new exciting chapter for me as a kid.
Now, I asked about your Molly origin stories to kind of demonstrate that there's a connection with American Girl dolls that I don't think we see with other lines. Mary, what is it about American Girl that can have that deep level of personal connection for the two of you and for so many of your podcast listeners?
Well, I think, you know, speaking for myself and for the stories that we've been lucky enough to collect from a lot of our listeners that are in the book, I think the design of the brand itself lent itself to that kind of lifelong connection. When Pleasant Rolland invented American Girl, she dreamed of the dolls and the books together as something that would encourage girls to both see themselves at the center of the story and also to learn through play, to read the stories, but then reinforce it by playing with the dolls and the world of accessories. And she also saw this as something that would be passed down at a speech that she gave at Colonial Williamsburg at the launch of Felicity. She gives us really beautiful, offers these remarks about, you know, envisioning this being passed down kind of matrilineally from mother to daughter and so on. And we've lived long enough that we've actually seen that happen. We are not parents ourselves, but we have a lot of listeners who are kind of reinvigorated with the brand by getting the chance to share them with a whole new generation.
And Allison, I should point out in the podcast, in the book, you and Mary are fans clearly of American Girl. You're not boosters. You don't look at it without criticism. Can you talk about, you know, as you look back as a grown up to your childhood experience, some of the questions that were raised?
Yeah, I think we've joked on the podcast that we're not in the pocket of big doll, so to speak, that, you know, we have enough distance from these things, both by aging and having some time away. You know, I collect dolls actively now along with accessories, but that's something I didn't do for a period of time. So I was able to kind of revisit the stories, revisit my collection, go back to this idea of collecting. And I think having criticism of things that you once loved is really good. It's a positive thing to do. We've never marketed this as a purely nostalgic trip down memory lane because we're really curious in what adults think about these things now and how new generations are interpreting them.
Talking to Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney, authors of the new book, Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. You can follow their podcast, Dolls of Our Lives, as well. We asked around Wisconsin Public Radio here for some memories of American Girl. Here's one of the responses we got.
This is Maureen McCollum, host of WPR's Wisconsin Life, and I am so happy to talk about my Kirsten doll. For those who don't know, Kirsten was one of the original American Girl dolls. She was a Swedish immigrant. Her family moved to the prairies of Minnesota sometime in the 1800s. And the Kirsten doll itself was one of my most treasured fancy possessions. My Aunt Mo gifted her to me when I was maybe 5 or 6. And then every Christmas or birthday, my aunt would send me another outfit or a little accessory to go with my Kirsten doll. And I actually just recently unearthed my Kirsten doll, pulled her out of a box, smelled super musty, but the dresses and the doll itself, like this wave of emotions came over me. Just this love for this doll returned and remembering how special she was. It's a feeling that just hasn't gone away over all these years.
Mary, can you talk? I'm guessing you've heard that from a lot of your podcast listeners, that personal connection, as Maureen said, after all those years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a powerful thing. I've heard stories like that so many times, and obviously I've experienced that myself. And, you know, what's really interesting is as she was talking, I was laughing because Allison and I had no memory of the stories of those books before we reread them on the show. And yet we could swear to anyone that they were so formative, not only to us as people, but of our choice to become historians. Like, for example, spoiler alert, Kirsten's best friend dies en route, you know, on their journey out west from cholera. And it's extremely tragic and traumatic for many people, apparently not us, because we had no memory of that before we sat down to reread those books.
And Allison, that is a common theme in a lot of these books. There are pretty traumatic situations that a lot of these doll-based characters face in their stories.
Yeah, the authors who were chosen by first, you know, Pleasant Rowland with her early company, you know, she came out of a background of education and media. And even the most recent authors, you know, perhaps most notably Britt Bennett, these are people who care a lot about telling great stories with children and for children. So they're not shying away from difficult topics. And we hear so often from people that this was the first time they really learned something real about a topic such as slavery. Even the books that take us to the War of 1812, a largely forgotten chapter in US history, they give us kind of these harrowing incidents where kids are doing things we don't expect. I don't know that we want to encourage children to be part of, you know, cannonball smuggling schemes, but we can all be proud, right, of a girl who frees herself from slavery. So they really give you a spectrum to dive into.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Lyon. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Liz?
I agree with both of you. I loved Molly because I couldn't get any information out of my grandfather. He refused to speak about his service in World War II, and I was obsessed with it at a young age.
And I think we lost Liz, but I think our producer, she's getting to the point that the books gave her some of that background. Mary, that reminds me, I think it was you talking about your grandma in the book where the Molly books were, even though she didn't read them, as I recall, the Molly books gave you a lot of conversation starters to talk about her life in the Depression and World War II eras.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, my grandmother, like it sounds like Liz's grandfather, didn't really want to talk about that period in her life voluntarily because it was a tough period of her life. There was a lot of privation and challenges. But because I could use the language of the Molly books, she really, you know, did satisfy my curiosity. And I learned so much about her that I probably wouldn't otherwise have known. And my own grandfather served in the war as well. And he passed away before I was born. So these books also are a way for me to invite her to share with me, you know, things about the life of a person I would never get to meet. So that was, you know, really special and important.
Thanks a lot for that call, Liz. Sorry we lost you at 800-642-1234. Michelle joins us now in Janesville. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that as an elementary teacher, I incorporated the Felicity series into my third grade classroom, and we did a whole unit study on the American Revolution using Felicity as our main source.
Interesting. And did the kids respond to that, Michelle?
You know, even like the girls were having an American Girl craze at that point mm-hmm. in time, but the boys really enjoyed the historical part of it. We found an interactive website that I pulled up on the smart board. We did crafting projects. We did cooking. It was a great resource for us to use.
Michelle, thanks a lot for that call. The girl and boy thing reminds me, was it you, Allison? I can't remember where you would be read to and the brothers in the family didn't want to have anything to do with this because it's a girl, but wait, they keep showing up to hear the books being read out loud.
That was actually
Mary's brother.
That was Mary. I'm sorry.
That's my
okay.
brothers. Yeah, no, it's okay. But yeah, they avowedly said it wasn't for them. It was girl stuff. But then one by one, they would join us. And we really all loved those books together.
Thanks a lot for that call. And the idea of this as part of a teaching tool, Allison, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what's so great about that phone call is in the Felicity books and any of these series, you see kids having a really important role in history. So kids are active agents, and they're not just experiencing something of the past, but they're going out, and sometimes they're doing things that maybe we're not so sure about as adults looking back. That's what creates some of the comedy and tension. But I think for any kind of kid to see that children experience the revolution in a certain way, that's something they're probably really not likely to get in textbooks. And you know, I talk about child labor with kids almost every day at my job, and hearing about kids in history can sometimes still be a novel thing.
Thanks again for that call. Michelle at 800-642-1234, talking to Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks. They are co-hosts of the podcast Dolls of Our Lives. Their new book is called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story to share about American Girl dolls in your own life or maybe a family member? Do you have questions for our guests about some of what they've explored in their podcast or the new book? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks, co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast, co-authors of a new book by the same name that explores the cultural impact, nostalgia, and more surrounding the American Girl brand of dolls. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, your experiences with American Girl. Join in at 800-642-1234 as a kid, as a parent, maybe as an employee of the company. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Again, we asked our WPR colleagues to share stories. Our own Rochelle Wilson had a deep cut to share.
So I have an American Girls deep cut. I used to play the American Girls premiere, an educational computer game that came on a CD-ROM back in the 90s. Basically, you could play with different American Girl characters and create these little stage plays on the computer with your own dialogue and movements. And my sisters and I loved to put little plays together. And it was just one of the ways that I connected with American Girl.
Mary, it's not just the books and dolls. And in the book, you write about people taking it further, using social media now to do, in effect, their own fan fiction types of videos. How much have people taken the original premises and run with them?
Well, you could say there's people are living out loud. They're taking a lot of latitude, and I'm here for it. You might imagine it as a kind of fan fiction or just kind of a re-engagement with the brand to, in some cases, you know, reignite that nostalgia you have for a childhood love of the brand, like the computer game, or to kind of incorporate more representation into a character story that you wish had been there at the start. So there's Instagram accounts like Lesbian Kirsten that argues just that, that Kirsten was a lesbian and or is a lesbian, I should say, and, you know, just creates representation around that. There's a lot of great interpreter or living history accounts that imagine this. And new kinds of stories. There's so much there, and it's really beautiful. There's we just had the photographer Sydney Paulson on our show. Her account is at Five Hens and Cockatiels on Instagram, and she works with the brand directly, doing stage photographs with the dolls, recreating movie scenes, and also of course scenes from the brand. So a lot of really interesting stuff out there.
Allison, something I wanted to get into before we run out of time is American Girl dolls and their connection with race and representation of people from different backgrounds. Can you talk a little bit about how that's evolved over the decades?
We've had, you know, really the privilege of a lot of people reaching out to us and sharing their stories, which are different from our own. And there's been some really fantastic think pieces. Aisha Harris has written extensively about the meaning of the Addie doll and her connections both to slavery and self-liberation. I think what has been really fascinating about doing the show is we get to be kind of this listening space. You know, you imagine a podcast as projecting out, but we hear so much from people who have these completely varied relationships with characters such as Josefina or Courtney or Kirsten. And the doll might be a kind of mirror for them in some way, or it might be a window to exploring something else, or they may have decided that it's too fraught, a relationship with a certain character. And so they've chosen to no longer own that doll or to do something different with it. So, you know, I think from think pieces to decisions people make about their own closets and their own collections, adults are generally really thoughtful about how they engage with American Girl.
Listeners can find a link to a Central Time conversation with Aisha Harris about the Addie doll at WPR.org. Just search our archives. We are talking to Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks. Their new book is called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. Back to your calls now. Janine is with us in Madison. Janine, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about Janine?
We were very lucky, and my mother-in-law worked for the Pleasant Company when Pleasant owned it. And all of her granddaughters received dolls that were signed by Pleasant. So, cherished dolls through our family.
Wow, Janine, that is fantastic. Do you still have yours, I should ask?
Well, it's actually my daughter's.
Your daughter's,
and
I'm sorry, yes.
We still have it in box because we're like, she had a whole bunch of other Pleasant Company dolls because she played with those. The signed one stayed in the box. But she was a very lucky girl because she grew up getting Pleasant Company paraphernalia for many years.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, Janine. Yeah, and we've heard some other stories of people, you know, when they have sales by the company locally in the Wisconsin area, having memories of finding those. Mary, the idea of the American Girl dolls as collector items, it seems like most people didn't just leave them in boxes. Do I have that wrong?
No, I mean, I think there's both. Allison's probably better to comment on this as a fellow collector, but I think they're both very well loved, but then some do actually keep them in pristine condition. So Allison, are yours more actively loved or do you keep yours in boxes?
Gosh, none of my dolls have seen a box since the day that they arrived on my front step. I was the same way with my Barbies, and from my family level, the play was always encouraged. And there are folks who say, gosh, you know, I wish I had really kept this more pristine. You know, you can always buy, someone is always willing to sell it, right, for some amount, but you can never get back the time that you enjoy playing with them. So that's how I rationalize having ruined a number of my dolls.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And the price of the American Girl dolls is something you tackle in the book a little bit. It's a barrier to entry for some people that raises some concerns, I think. Mary, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a very real concern. I think Pleasant at the time would say that when American Girl debuted, she said, you know, a Nintendo game system costs far more than an American Girl doll and the books. So, you know, this is not a fair critique, but I think for many families and people, you know, these dolls were beyond reach. And a lot of listeners have shared with us that this was sometimes occasioned the first real conversations they had about money as a family when they would ask for a doll for a birthday. And, you know, it was just not in the budget. And some fans grew up as adults, you know, with the dream of buying a doll for themselves, even as, you know, folks who aren't parents, just to kind of like as a kind of wish fulfillment of a childhood wish. But I do think that those class barriers are real and, you know, definitely something that endures with the brand.
Allison, something I got to ask. Now, sometimes when I go back and read a cherished book from my youth, sometimes it's great. Sometimes it doesn't hold up. What was the experience like of picking up these books that you'd read and, as Mary mentioned earlier, mostly forgotten? Was it fun to read them again?
Oh, they're definitely fun to reread. I think Molly was probably the hardest because we have, you know, just romanticized certain ideas and qualities about her. And there are pages where you're just so reminded as a reader in your 30s that she's 9, you know, or she's 10 years old and she's grappling with things. She and I still have a lot in common. Like, we won't eat turnips. You know, that's like an early Molly reference. But the truth is, it's a lot of fun to revisit these things. I think if you go in with an open mind, right, and you're willing to see how the text hasn't changed, but you have, and that can be a great experience.
We'll leave it there. Allison and Mary, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney are historians and co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast. We've been talking about the cultural legacy of the Wisconsin-based American Girl brand and their new book, Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. You can keep sharing your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.